And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
Have you ever thought about what previous civilizations must have thought as they lived through the changes that either spelled their ascension to power or had to adapt to their falling from grace? Babylonians, Greeks, Romans, Persians, Austrian. These are the headings of the history of empire. Today, we hear about the sudden collapse, perhaps, of a most unique empire, as we head as far north as one can go to hear the news from the North Polar regions. Better listen quick, because it's a brand new world coming up here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
We live in a world of wild speculation. Everyone has an opinion of the truth. And depending on who you are, your opinion can change the course of history. That certainly is the case when it comes to the future of our little planet. Speculation, which in many cases is couched as science, can have enormous effects on our sense of well-being. As it certainly did as we headed into this hurricane season, what with Katrina celebrating her second birthday and the specter that global warming could make this hurricane season the worst on record. Well, so far, somewhat ordinary. Here on Earth, we're hearing about global warming, mass extinction, peak oil, and the like. And speculators, scientists, and people with good common sense can't even begin to agree on what this is all supposed to mean. Strangely, the debate over global warming serves as a fulcrum upon which our future seems to rest. And to date, the debate has been tipping one way or the other. Reason is a reasonable thing, unless, of course, there are factors that one cannot factor in. That just may be the case in this debate. And today, we hear the latest news from the North Polar regions about that elusive ice cap upon which indigenous peoples and polar bears must depend for the traditional ways of life. Now, if you are a polar bear, or if you think much about them, then you need to listen up and listen good, because the news is, well, that's coming up in segment two. We'll hear from Dr. Walt Myers, research scientist, with the National Snow and Science Data Center in Boulder, Colorado. It is time to pay attention. We'll hear that and the latest nature news, but first, as always, it's time for the weekly Earth Summit. Welcome to the Weekly Earth Summit. Today, our regular panelists provide an overview of thought on issues and observations of our world and your future. So now, we're pleased to open this week's summit with a challenge for all of us from Dr. Matthew Sleeth, who just returned from a month traveling around the country, bringing a call to action to the nation's faith communities.
I have been to the mountain, and it was not there. This is not poetry, but the reality I confronted a week ago in eastern Kentucky. The Appalachian Mountains are being laid to waste in an operation called mountaintop removal. More accurately, it is the mountaintop, middle, bottom, and valley that is destroyed in the process of extracting the 3-foot seam of coal that fuel America's energy needs. Only a poet could do justice to the phenomenon of the missing mountain. It is a hard thing to get my mind around, much less my soul. I lack the skill to convey my horror. Thousands of years ago, a Hebrew poet penned the 148th Psalm, and I quote, "Praise the Lord from the earth, you great sea creatures in all ocean depths, lightning and hail, snow and clouds, stormy winds that do his bidding, you mountains and hills," end quote. How many of those things which glorify our Creator and give beauty to our world will be laid to waste in an effort to fulfill our wants. The answer is in our hands every time we turn on a clothes dryer, television, or lamp. Moses received the Ten Commandments on a mountain, and Jesus preached his greatest sermon on one. He said that if we had the faith, we could move mountains. Now I pray that the same power can preserve the mountain. Lastly, seeing mountains removed and valley streams buried brings into vivid reality the childish notion that we can use non-renewable resources and then pay a fee to offset the result. Once a mountain is destroyed, it is gone, and no carbon indulgence paid can offset or mitigate the sin of its removal.
Thank you, Dr. Sleeth. Dave Foreman has served in years past on the board of the Sierra Club. As always, he cuts his own path to tomorrow and invites those brave enough to follow.
In my 35 years as a conservationist, I have never beheld such a bleak and depressing situation as I see today. The evidence for my despair falls into three categories: the state of nature, the power of anti-conservationists, and appeasement and weakness within the conservation and environmental movements. I fear that on some level, we must recognize that this state of affairs may be inevitable and impossible to turn around. That is the coward's way out, though. The bleakness we face is all the more reason to stand tall for our values and to not flinch in the good fight. In December of 1776, the American Revolution was in its darkest hour. In response, Tom Paine wrote his first crisis paper. "These are the times that try men's souls. The summer soldier and the sunshine patriot will, in this crisis, shrink from the service of his country. But he that stands it now deserves the love and thanks of man and woman." General Washington had the paper read to his miserable, disheartened troops in their frozen winter camps. There was no surrender. Years of hard battle lay ahead, but victory was gained. We need Tom Paine conservationists in our dark hour. Let us not apologize for loving wild nature, for caring about other species, for speaking the truth. Reach out to others. Make deals when they are good deals. But let us not be frightened and browbeaten into appeasement. Let us instead offer a bold, hopeful vision for how wilderness and civilization can live together.
Thanks, Dave. Ben Lowe is like a young Dave Foreman, an activist and effective voice for the earth. He speaks specifically on behalf of the incredible faith-based community, which is quickly emerging as a powerful and effective friend of the earth. Ben?
I just got back from four nights of camping in Boise, Idaho. Idaho is a beautiful state with many great camping spots, but this time I was not in the hills or by a river. This time I was camping in the field behind the Vineyard Boise Church. I was joined by a diverse group of students, Christian environmentalists, and church leaders, many who opted to stay in local hotels instead. Word on the street is that all the cool kids were actually camping, though. We came together for what was a very encouraging Creation Care Summit, filled with worship, prayer, learning, and fellowship. We heard reports from the Reverend Richard Cizik, Vice President for Governmental Affairs of the National Association of Evangelicals, and many other pastors, leaders, and organizations. Everyone present testified that there has been a sea change among Christians in the last few years. A building majority of evangelicals are recovering a vision for environmental stewardship and are taking action all across the nation. Our host church is just one such example. Led by their senior pastor, Tri Robinson, the Vineyard Boise Church in Idaho headed up a recycling ministry in their parking lot called Tithe Your Trash. They plant a large organic garden on site and donate the produce to families in the community, along with goods for their food pantry. Members of the church also frequently work with local rangers to clear trails and plant trees in the nearby wilderness areas. I came back from this conference greatly encouraged. What an inspiring model of community-based environmental stewardship, and a mere foretaste of all the good work God is preparing for us to do.
Thanks, Ben. You can find out about Ben's work by visiting aroca.org, A-R-O-C-H-A dot O-R-G. Dr. Charles Kennell is forging the Sustainability Institute at the University of California, San Diego. He brings to this task a wide and rich awareness of the state of the ark. I welcome Dr. Kennel to share his thoughts. Dr. Kennel?
The 2007 IPCC report projects a global warming of 0.2 degrees centigrade per decade over the next 2 decades, twice what we experienced at the end of the 20th century. But even if we could hold greenhouse gas and aerosol concentrations back at their year 2000 level, which we have not done and cannot do, we're going to get 0.1 degree per decade for a century or more. And this means that no matter what we do about fossil fuel use, we'll have to adapt to the climate change that's already in store for us. And in particular, California and the American West are going to have to cope with the long-term drying trend. People don't live on the globe. They live in regions and communities. They have their own environments, their ecologies, economics, politics, and social attitudes. While the IPCC can forecast the global drivers of regional climate change, they can't be expected to understand the needs of the citizens living in every region of the world. California has 16 distinct climatic regions, as anyone who drives inland from the ocean can easily appreciate. And Californians care about their 16 regions. We need to do our own assessments. We're already leading the way. The California Energy Commission's Our Changing Climate Assessment set the context with the agreements between California and the UK and amongst the 5 western states, all to cooperate on climate change. This shows how regional assessments, how influential they can be. Assessments are going to have to become a way of life for California. State agencies will use them in important water management and natural hazard decisions. How high and when should we rebuild the levees in the Sacramento Delta? Farmers and the banking institutions that finance agriculture need them. The Department of Forestry will use their wildfire forecast. Energy companies will use their forecasts of electricity usage and hydropower generation in making their investment decisions. Environmental managers in our cities, towns, and parks will use them. The protection of California's ecosystems and wildlife will depend on them. Fisheries managements will use them. In 10 years' time, climate science may be able to reduce the lead time of its forecast to 10 years. This would give highly actionable information to investors and government, and we should adopt this as a goal for California now.
Regional thinking is where you live. Perhaps the term bioregional perspective may stage a comeback. Thank you, Dr. Kennel. We are all in this together. Dr. Thomas Lovejoy knows this as well as anyone. Dr. Lovejoy, thanks for your thoughts this week.
Now, we recently had the report of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change about the impacts of climate change on the natural world. And I think it's quite clear now that the natural world is the most sensitive of all the things we care about that can be affected by climate change. We're seeing changes in nature all over the world, changes in flowering time, changes in nesting time, species changing where they live, changing in altitude, changing in latitude. We're seeing mismatches where one species in a relationship depends on day length, the other depends on temperature, and suddenly they're no longer in sync. And we're seeing thresholds passed in ecosystems so that, for example, in the Northwest and British Columbia and Southern Alaska, the coniferous forests are suddenly being attacked in a major way by a native pest, the pine bark beetle, but with warmer summer nights and essentially longer summers, suddenly the balance is tipped in their favor. So there are places where 70% of the trees are dead. So basically, if we allow climate change to go on business as usual and get worse, we're going to see the very biological underpinnings of human society be shaken in an unprecedented way. So nature is telling us it's time to get the climate change and greenhouse gas problem under control.
In order to truly build a global response, it will take the united efforts of professionals from around the globe. Building that effort through action, we now invite Dr. Robin Moore to invite everyone around the world interested in the future of amphibians to begin building that united effort. Dr. Moore?
In September 2005, over 60 of the world's leading experts in amphibian conservation and research convened in Washington, D.C. for an amphibian summit. This summit was a response to mounting evidence over the preceding decades that amphibians have been going extinct and declining worldwide. This realization prompted the global community to come together to formulate a response. The summit tackled a number of themes from disease, climate change, captive breeding and reintroduction, to develop a global strategy in the form of the Amphibian Conservation Action Plan. This action plan will be published within the next couple of months. Associated with the action plan was a budget of $400 million. This is the amount it was estimated it would cost to halt the crisis. Prior to the summit, a number of disparate bodies had been tackling amphibian conservation at the global scale. The Declining Amphibian Populations Task Force had made amazing advances in our knowledge of amphibian declines worldwide. The Global Amphibian Assessment had provided an update on the status of amphibians and continues to provide an update on the status. Following the summit, it was realized that a unified global entity was required to tackle the problem at the scale necessary. This led to the formation of the Amphibian Specialist Group, into which the Declining Amphibian Populations Task Force folded, and the Global Amphibian Assessment will also fold. If you'd like more information about the Amphibian Specialist Group, including the bi-monthly newsletter Froglog, which details the activities of the Amphibian Specialist Group and amphibian researchers working in the field, please visit the website www.amphibians.org.
We must unite our observations of the changes taking place. That means we all have to pay attention to the real world around us. Dr. Mark Beckhoff sends us onward with some of his observations on how paying attention to the wild creatures applies to our broader lives. Dr. Beckhoff.
Yeah, one of the really interesting things that I try to do is people ask me, well, what does knowing about animal behavior do for you in terms of encountering a wild animal? I'll say, well, when you see a mountain lion, you're supposed to stand upright and scream and make yourself really big. If you have a bike, wave the bike. If you have a stick, wave the stick. Of course, what I've done in the past when I've had the lion encounters is I run, because that's what you instinctively do. But people are also interested in practical issues, like what happens when a real aggressive dog comes up to you. Well, what I generally do is I turn and walk away very slowly. Sometimes I'll face the dog, but generally I'll turn around and I'll walk away slowly. I won't make any sudden move. I surely won't run away fast, although I want to, because that's like a pursuit invitation signal, we call it. That's an invitation for the animal to chase you. Some people say that if you roll over and you're really scared and you pee in your pants, that might work, and it might. I've never done that. But my tendency with a real aggressive dog is to just get away slowly, simply because they can be pretty unpredictable. And you just, you know, you don't know about the history of the dog. You don't know the dog's psychological makeup. And so by lying down, you may, you know, be exposing a vulnerable part of your body. So I think that, you know, those are sort of lessons from animal behavior. When I encounter coyotes around my house, once again, I walk away slowly. I may say, you know, I may talk to them in a really, really gentle, mellow voice. But, you know, sometimes with a mountain lion, you have to confront them. With this bear on my porch, I didn't know what to do. And, you know, I've heard reports from other people about, you know, bears and even coyotes, that they're so habituated, this bear didn't flinch. He finally ran off my porch when I went to the door, and I was standing at the screen door, and I was starting to close the glass sliding porch door, and I noticed he was backing up a bit. So I opened the door a bit, because I knew I could actually shut it before he could get in it, and I just kind of looked at him, and very gently I said, "What are you doing here? You know, please leave my porch." And then when I stepped towards him, and I was probably only about 3 feet from him, but still protected partly by the door, he ran off the porch. So there's a problem, I think you can see, that with habituated animals, you just don't know what to do. The other problem, of course, is a lot of these animals have been shed, and then they people stop feeding them, and that's the worst of the worst situation. When you read about kids getting attacked by wildlife or even adults, it's because the wildlife have been fed, and then they stop feeding them, and they're accustomed to food.
I want to thank this great alliance of advocates that will be meeting and sharing their thoughts each week on the weekly Earth Summit here on the Wild Side News. Now do what you can, which means to spread the word about the most important 15 minutes on Earth until we convene again next week. This is your host, Sidney Wildsmith. See you then. One of the greatest stories ever written was Alice in Wonderland, where the poor Alice found herself in a world of changing realities, much of which was out of her control. That just may be a useful way to look at our own future as the natural balance of life becomes disrupted. In a moment, we're heading up to the North Pole as we get brought up to date on the latest about the elusive Arctic ice. Alice may have said it best when she mused, "Curiouser and curiouser." Stay tuned.
I'm getting a catcher's mitt.
I'm getting ice skates.
I'm getting a jigsaw puzzle.
I'm getting dying coral reefs.
A blue bicycle.
A walkie-talkie.
I'm getting a severe drought.
Cool black skateboard.
I'm getting melted ice caps.
A killer heat wave.
A shrinking glacier.
I'm getting a devastating flood.
Adults are generous. We're even giving kids global warming. But it's not too late. We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. Go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sidney Wildsmith.
We all heard a few weeks back a story right out of Alice in Wonderland about Russia planting a flag in the deep waters off its northern shores in some of the world's most inhospitable lands, which encompass the Arctic region. But there's actually a story behind the story, and it just may make more sense than at first glance seemed appropriate. There's a whole new world to explore, and there just may be lots and lots of fresh resources. We find out why when your Voice of the Earth continues, here on the Wild Side News. In just a moment, we bring you the latest nature news, and then we bring you up to date on a story that needs special attention. Here's the bottom line. That Arctic ice shelf that swells to fill the Arctic regions each winter, then melts back each spring and summer? Well, scientists have been cautious not to seem alarmist when they speculated that global warming could cause the complete disappearance of that ice by the year 2100. Today, we bring you the news that perhaps, if we're lucky, it may last for another 20 or so years. Or, if things don't go well, that story is coming up. But first we bring you this week's Nature News. So now, the news. Researchers using a newly developed ultra-small camera have discovered behaviors never before captured, which prove conclusively that animals as relatively basic as crows have a highly developed propensity to use tools of all sorts in their day-to-day lives. The cameras, weighing less than a couple of quarters, were mounted to New Caledonian crows, which have been studied for quite some time for their unique problem-solving abilities. Capturing the actions of the bird's head area from below, the cameras captured tool crafting from leaves, tool use for turning over objects on the ground, and most amazingly, the repeated use of favorite tools which were carried along from place to place. Much could be said about these scientific discoveries, and we will in the months ahead on the Wild Side News, and even more promising is the prospect that such small cameras, when used with other animals, may enrich the literal perceptions of the scientists as they may come to realize the advanced capacity for even small creatures to reason, craft unique solutions, and expand the awareness of the extraordinary richness of life on Earth. Picking straws to see who goes first might be the best solution to determine if China or the United States will be the first major superpower to fully commit to sustainability, or so says David Hawkins of the National Resources Defense Council. The NRDC is suggesting that if and when the U.S. were to commit to actions to reduce global warming, China would quickly follow in order to be sure to keep up with advancing technologies, particularly as China is more deeply aware and acknowledges the threats from global warming than the U.S. is currently prepared to admit. Once the two giants moved in that direction, the entire globe would benefit. Unfortunately, in a related story, Senator Bingaman of New Mexico, who is a quiet advocate for action to curb global warming, warned that there would be no effective laws passed to fight climate change until George W. Bush leaves office in 2009. For the United States to have a leadership role in this whole discussion, Bingaman is quoted, we're going to have to do something ourselves to demonstrate our own commitment to dealing with the problem. He went on, until that happens, until we adopt a cap-and-trade system economy-wide or take some significant step to start controlling greenhouse gas emissions, we're not going to be deferred to in any serious way by the international community on this subject. China this week agreed to phase out incandescent bulbs in favor of more energy-efficient ones as part of a push backed by a leading world environmental funding agency. China currently produces 70% of the world's light bulbs. This move will have a significant effect on global lighting trends and help to reduce greenhouse gases by 500 million tons. Travelers are expected to begin changing their travel plans, particularly overseas flights, as they become more conscious of the effects that international flights have on greenhouse gases and about their capacity to make choices that make for a cleaner world. This, according to the UN Environment Program, the World Meteorological Organization, and the World Tourism Organization. And finally, cities around the U.S. are joining influential restaurateurs and activists in a public campaign launched Wednesday to convince consumers to choose tap water over bottles. Boston and Salt Lake City, as well as cities in California, such as Emeryville and San Leandro, have signed on to the campaign. Critics claim that bottled water wastes energy and resources through production of plastic bottles and energy used in the shipping process. They are challenging the very lucrative bottled water industry that isn't thirsting for profits in the $11 billion a year industry. Launching city by city, the campaign is making quick headway and hopes to transform this wasteful choice into a more reasonable alternative called city water. And that's the news. And a few announcements. Hope all my friends who are receiving the weekly email updates on the Wild Side News enjoy the new look of our newsletter. It provides a quick summary of the topics of the show, and you'll be seeing some great new offerings in the months ahead. If you'd like to receive these free weekly updates and stay informed about the latest news and opinions of leading Earth advocates and actionaries, send an email with subscribe or some such in the subject line or body to wildsidenews@cox.net. That's wildsidenews@cox.net. You'll be glad you did. And now we head on over to Boulder, Colorado, as we get the latest news on what's happening in those elusive Arctic waters. This is an important new development in the saga of global warming. Take a good listen to this. The debate on global warming, some people would say, is already resolved, But there still are those who keep suggesting that it's not a resolved issue. And to be fair, it probably isn't a resolved issue because almost anything can change. I guess maybe that's really the centerpiece of what we're going to talk about today, which are the changes that are happening in the Arctic ice shelf that is up towards the top of the world. In the sense that it's a change that has been discussed, and people have been talking about the fact that perhaps by the year 2100 or so, that ice sheet may be entirely gone. Well, there's some new news, and it's really quite startling news. And to really get a handle on this with the people who are doing the research in the field, on the ground, have the historical record, and can really analyze this, we're now going to Boulder, Colorado, and talking with Dr. Walt Meyer, who's with the National Science and Ice Data Center. Dr. Meyer, welcome to the Wildside News.
Thank you.
Dr. Meyer, you're involved in researching ice. Why don't you give us a little background on the NSIDC and its mission?
Sure. We're the National Snow and Ice Data Center, and we're primarily a data archive center for particularly NASA data, but any data that's taken in the cryosphere, any snow and ice data that is collected by scientists, we house that and distribute it to interested users, in general freely available to any users for research or whatever. We also have a very vibrant research group here of about a dozen scientists, including myself, that do cryospheric research and looking at what the data is telling us and how to interpret the data and how to understand things that we're seeing going on based on the data.
What we're going to focus on today is the Arctic ice, but does your research cover the entire globe?
Yes, we cover snow and ice anywhere it occurs around the globe, whether it be tropical glaciers such as Kilimanjaro or the Antarctic, snow cover in the northern hemisphere and the southern hemisphere. Pretty much anything that's snow and ice, we have some data on it.
Any trend lines that you can share with us in terms of this kind of overall global perspective on the storage of water in these massive ice systems?
Well, what we're seeing is a definite downward trend in the basically the total amount of ice. In terms of sea ice, which is a relatively small component in terms of total mass or total volume, that's the frozen ocean surface, which is generally on the order of 5 to 10 feet thick on average. So it's a small component compared to the Antarctic or Greenland ice sheets, which are several thousands of feet thick. However, it's a very sensitive area, and it covers a large surface area of the Earth. For example, the Arctic, when it reaches its minimum on average in the summertime in September, it covers roughly the area of the lower 48 United States. And so that's a pretty sizable area that's covered with ice. And what we're seeing is pretty dramatic decreases over the last about 30 years, particularly in the Arctic sea ice. We've lost we're losing it at a rate now of about 10% per decade, and that's really accelerating in these recent years as we're getting more and more data and things are changing quite rapidly. And what that's led to is basically we've taken the size of the 48 U.S. states, and we've up through last year, we basically have chopped off everything east of the Mississippi. That's how much ice has decreased compared to what we used to have in the 70s and 80s. And then this year, we lost another area the size of roughly the size of Texas and California. So you can take that area off as well. So it's really a pretty dramatic change when you think of it.
Well, here's the thing that's I find intriguing about this emerging story of global warming or climate change, or as I like to refer to it, global weirding, because it's going to be expressing itself in so many different ways. It isn't just a warming trend. It's just a change. It's like I like to think of this as a tire on a car is in balance. That thing will go 80 miles an hour, 90 miles an hour, and everything is smooth, but it doesn't take much of a small imbalance in that tire, and at 50 miles an hour, it starts to really wobble, and it won't go 80. And that's kind of what's happening here, is that these changes are beginning to really magnify, and it's really impossible to know how it's all going to act out. One of the stories that we've been talking about in terms of global warming, specifically with the Arctic ice shelf, is that we might be looking at the possibility that perhaps by the year 2100, it might get to the point where that ice shelf is no longer there, and there would be radical changes to the wildlife and cultures up there. But now, all of a sudden, there's really quite a different story. Within a matter of years, the story has completely changed. Why don't you give us an introduction to what that new story is?
Sure. We've been seeing this decline since the late 1970s, and really from other data we have since the 1950s. But it started out as a significant decline, but a relatively consistent and relatively steady decline. But what we've seen in the last about 5 to 6 years is kind of a dramatic increase in the rate of that decline. And what we've originally projected and what climate models had been saying is that, if this decline keeps going as it's been going, as we might expect it would, we might see the Arctic free of ice during the summertime by maybe 2100. But the Arctic ice doesn't necessarily respond in a nice, predictable, linear way. There's feedbacks that can accelerate things. And that's been known, but what wasn't known was exactly when those feedbacks might kick in and how big they might be. But what we're seeing now in the last 5 to 10 years is definite evidence that those feedbacks are kicking in, and kicking in very strongly, and the rate has accelerated dramatically, such that we're now looking at perhaps by 2030, maybe even a few years sooner, we'll have the Arctic sea ice will completely melt away during the summertime. It will regrow in the winter, of course, but an Arctic that's ice-free, even for part of the year, is a fundamental change in character of the whole ecosystem of the Arctic, and it's something that we're going to see happen within many people's lifetimes, not something that's going to be for future generations to worry about, which was thought even a few years ago.
You know, one of the factors that is leading to these conclusions is the fact that there has been such a sudden, dramatic change in terms of the amount of ice that is, as you say, the summer ice, between 2005 and 2007. It's been a dramatic decline that was unpredictable.
Yeah, I don't think anyone thought, if you had asked someone even in March or April of this year, or even May or June probably, are we gonna set a record? They may have said, yeah, we have a pretty good chance of setting a record, but are we gonna go as low as we've gone this year? I think there's very few people would have gone down as low as what the prediction was. When we set the record, the last record we had was set in 2005. That broke a previous record and set in 2002. And the 2005, we called it shattering the 2002 record. In retrospect, that we either have to come up with new language or maybe that shattering was too strong of a word, relatively speaking. It seemed like we were setting a shattering record in 2005. It was so far below what we had seen previously. But we broke 2005's record by more than double what 2005 broke 2002's record. So we're really seeing an acceleration in these trends and this decrease that we see every year from year to year. And that's something that, again, is quite surprising, I think.
It's I won't say it's exponential, but it's not linear.
It's certainly not linear. It may not be quite exponential, but it certainly looks like we're heading kind of over a cliff in a way. We're passing a tipping point where it's just going to keep going down, and it might keep going down faster and faster. And it's putting us at a point where it's going to be very hard, and really at this point I think you'd be hard-pressed to figure out a way that we would be able to stop it anytime soon. I think we're heading towards a time, inevitably, whether it's going to be 10 years from now or 20 years or 30 years, we're heading towards a time where the Arctic is going to be ice-free during the summertime.
Mm-hmm. And we'll end up by talking about what that may mean to some extent to the animal life and cultures there. But I think it might be useful because there may be some people who are listening to this and they don't really quite understand what we're talking about, which has to do with this annual cycle up there. Give us a brief overview so that people get a picture of what we're talking about here.
In the summertime, we reach a minimum. That's, you know, you get the sunlight up in the north, and you get warmer days, and it melts back over the course of the spring and summer. And then, as the sun starts to go down, and you head into the northern hemisphere winter, it gets cold. It gets dark up there, and the ice grows. The ocean gets down to freezing and starts freezing into sea ice. And that progresses until around March, which is when we reach the maximum, and that's about double the size of what it normally is in the summertime. So we go from roughly the lower 48 United States to roughly double that in March. And then the sun comes up, and then we melt back and go down towards the minimum, which is reached in September. And so you have this pretty strong seasonal cycle. It doubles in size, the ice-covered area, from the summertime to the wintertime. And then what we're seeing, what we're looking at is these kind of long-term trends, specifically in the summertime is what we've been talking about now, which is where we've seen the really steep declines and the accelerating declines. So each year the ice grows back in the winter, and then it melts, but it's melting more in the summer than it's growing in the winter, and so you keep getting less and less every summer. And we have seen decreases in the winter over the last several years as well. It's still nearly doubling in size, or even a little bit more than doubling in size, but it's less than it had been in previous winters. So that you're getting this kind of feedback mechanism where it's just not growing as thick, it's not growing as fast, it's not growing as much in the wintertime, and then you get the summertime, and the temperatures are warmer, and year after year after year, and it just keeps melting more than you're refreezing. And so you get this cycle where it's just a kind of a downward spiral, in a sense.
It's like a momentum of change.
Right.
The change has its own momentum. There's many aspects to this, which has also included a strange rush to that area by nations who wish to claim the potential resources, and that's a whole other story. Maybe that's where the next grand oil fields are to be found, and there's many people who are expecting that to happen, and that, again, has its own spin on that, and the consequences of that are yet to be determined. But one of the stories that comes out as well is that used to be the Northwest Passage. That was always a dream for mariners, that they could, instead of having to go way down to the Panama Canal now to go from the Pacific to the Atlantic, there was this potential northern route, but unfortunately, because of the summer ice, it was never possible to really go through that area unless you use the ice trawlers and ice-breaking ships. But that's different now, isn't it?
Certainly this year. The Northwest Passage has been traversed several times over the years by various ships, mostly ice-strengthened ships, and it's a kind of an arduous, expensive, and somewhat dangerous task. It was never really a practical route to get from the Atlantic to the Pacific. It was never something that you could depend on. Now, this year, pretty much the entire Northwest Passage, and not just kind of the traditional route, but other routes that were even more direct and more safe potentially and shorter, opened up. And we had the lowest amount of ice throughout the Northwest Passage than anyone's ever seen, certainly in the any time we've been tracking it. And based on anecdotal things compared to even going back into the 1500s and the earliest explorers, of course, people weren't there every year and exploring every square inch like we can do now. But at least anecdotally, this was something that was just never really feasible. And this year, certainly, it would have been. It was really completely free of ice, other than, you know, little bits and chunks of ice here and there that were hanging on. But it looked much like any normal sea route, essentially. Now, a key thing to keep in mind is, now this year it opened up, but there is a lot of variability from year to year, and variability both overall in terms of how much ice is present, but also even within the Arctic and where the ice is. For example, one of the routes is the other side of the Arctic, which is called the Northern Sea Route, which goes along the north coast of Russia. Mm-hmm. That has traditionally, especially in recent years, been pretty open. And the Russians have used that as a sea route to take ships through. They usually had icebreakers with them just in case they ran into ice. But it was relatively open, certainly much more open compared to the Northwest Passage. This year, however, that route was completely closed by a line of ice, a thick, very hard to navigate through ice, pretty much impossible this year, whereas the Northwest Passage was open.
That's very interesting.
So we're you know, even though this year it was open in the Northwest Passage, I couldn't say it would be next year. And even as we get into these areas where we have what we call ice-free arctics, there may still be ice, patchy ice in a few areas, and it may be enough to clog the one route through the Northwest Passage or whatever. So it's still a bit of an iffy thing, but certainly the ice is going to be more open. There's going to be more times when the Northwest Passage is open, and it's going to be easier to get through. Even if there is ice there, it's going to be thinner and easier to get through.
Well, I think maybe next year I'm going to give you a call as this starts to emerge. And if it looks as if that the Northwest Passage is going to be open, I think we'll schedule the first eco-tour through that area.
you certainly may see that. You know, there's been, I know of at least one relatively small sailboat, about a 50-foot sailboat, that went through this year without any problem at all. It went through in a couple months.
A 50-foot sailboat, that would be crushed in any other circumstance.
Right, right. This group, they tried to do it a couple times before in previous years, and that nearly happened, basically. They had to get rescued by a Canadian icebreaker, and they did not make it successfully. And this year, they really didn't encounter any problem at all.
Well, not to be fair, I mean, you know, next year could be totally different.
And right.
It could change.
That's certainly true.
There could be a trend 5 years from now. We may be looking back and saying, oh, boy, were we wrong. I mean, we just have to be fair about this. This happens to be a unique feature that's happening, a trend that appears to be developing right now, but that trend could change as well.
Yeah, I think certainly in specific areas like the Northwest Passage, the overall downward trend is going to be hard to turn around anytime soon. Certainly next year, we may not see it near as low as this year. You know, it often tends to recover a little bit in years afterwards. You know, in 2005, we set a record. Well, in 2006, it bounced back a little bit. Certainly not to what used to be normal, but it wasn't really close to the 2005 record. And so, next year, I wouldn't necessarily bet on breaking the record, because there's this natural variability that we see from year to year. And that's one of the things that happened this year that made it so extreme. It wasn't just the long-term trend. This was far outside of this long-term downward trend. But what we saw, it was very warm. There was relatively clear skies. It was much sunnier there, particularly in the middle of the summertime, you know, right when we had the maximum solar heating. And that really burned away a lot of the ice. The ice also moves around, and we saw a pattern of circulation where the ice kind of got pushed away from the coastlines and pushed that edge of that ice away from where it normally would be.
From winds and things of that nature.
From winds, right. And next year it could be the opposite. We could have winds kind of pushing the ice towards the coast. We could have cloudier skies. We could have cooler conditions. And all that would serve to slow the annual melt that we see through the summertime and give us not near as low of a minimum as we had this year.
Now, also, apparently there was a unique kind of high-pressure zone which was creating this continuous clear weather, otherwise known as sunny skies.
Mm-hmm.
And as you said, that does contribute. Any idea if that high-pressure zone is somehow a factor of this global weirding, the dynamics that are shifting?
You know, it certainly could be. This year the high pressure gives you kind of fair skies. The Arctic is normally a pretty cloudy place, especially in the summertime. Things upwards of 80-90% cloud cover is quite common in the Arctic. And this year it was, there was still clouds there, but it was much clearer than it normally is. And one of the things we've seen over the years, there's been what's called an Arctic oscillation, and not to get into too many nitty-gritty details, but it's basically two modes of circulation. One of them tends to keep the ice around in the Arctic, another one tends to push it out of the Arctic, and so one will kind of give you higher levels of ice, and the other will give you lower, and it tends to flip back and forth. But one of the things we've seen is that has been pretty neutral. It hasn't been in a mode. It wasn't the mode in the late 80s and early 90s where it was dumping out a lot of ice and helping to contribute to the decline in the ice cover, but we haven't seen that in the last several years. But we've seen these other types of patterns, like this high pressure, which isn't directly linked to this Arctic oscillation. These things have set up to keep skies clear, to pump warmer air from the south end. And it's not quite clear, are these a result of the warming temperatures that we've seen? Is it just natural variability? It's kind of hard to say right now. One of the things that has been talked about is this Arctic oscillation would tend to be more in a mode that would push the ice out under warmer temperatures. It's a possibility that this global warming will accentuate conditions that further melt the ice beyond just the warmer temperatures.
Now, of course, what everybody is with news like this, that there's a sudden dramatic change in the Arctic ice, then certain people around the world are going to say, wait a second, does this mean I should be packing up and, you know, heading away from the shore because the oceans are going to suddenly rise? Is this going to accelerate the ocean rise? Talk about Arctic ice and its effect on literal ocean height.
The sea ice, which is the frozen ocean, that's not going to raise sea level when that goes away directly.
So we don't have to worry. That's number one about that.
So you don't have to worry about that. It's like, you know, you have a glass full of, with ice, and the ice melts. Well, it doesn't overflow the glass.
Right.
However, we have this big, huge chunk of ice sitting on land in Greenland.
Right.
Several thousand feet thick.
Right.
And we've already seen that melting and calving off icebergs and calving off ice at a much faster rate than people had ever anticipated.
And there's kind of a correlation between your story and theirs in the sense that it also is accelerating faster than people were prepared to predict.
Right. It's definitely moved faster. There's things that are happening on Greenland that people hadn't really thought about in terms of how the ice is moving and how the ice moves off the land and into the ocean and how the ocean can affect it. One of the things that we see, the sea ice, doesn't directly raise sea level. But what it does is, it does a few things. Number one, the ice is a cap on the ocean. And so it basically insulates the ocean from the atmosphere and keeps the ocean in certain conditions and may keep the ocean cooler and the atmosphere cooler, certainly, than if the ice isn't there. And you start taking away the ice, and all of a sudden, the glaciers that come off of Greenland, they used to flow into areas that were covered by sea ice a lot of times, and the sea ice would kind of buffer things. And now, if you don't have the sea ice there, or don't have it there longer during the year, suddenly those glaciers that are floating on the ocean are exposed to different conditions. And we're seeing a lot of the acceleration, at least initially, is due to warmer ocean temperatures that are hitting these ice shelves, as we call them, coming off of Greenland, and disintegrating these shelves and calving off glaciers. And these shelves acted as breaks on the snow and ice farther up on the land, and so now it's flowing faster than it used to. And that's an indirect consequence of the sea ice. On the other hand, it actually could have an opposite effect, too, to some extent, in that sea ice, again, acts as a cap. It acts as, it prevents moisture from the ocean going up in the atmosphere and keeps the Arctic relatively dry compared to a lot of places. Well, if you remove the sea ice, suddenly you have a lot more moisture in the air, and you can get more snowfall in Greenland, which would tend to add to the mass. And we're actually seeing some of that. In the high elevations of Greenland, it's gaining some mass, and that's because of increased snowfall. And that fits right with what we're seeing with the declining sea ice and the warmer temperatures. But we're seeing much more dramatic declines around the edges of Greenland. So there's a net mass loss, but in certain areas you can see a gain of mass in Greenland. And we also expect we might see things like that in terms of snowfall around the coast, the Arctic coast in Alaska and Canada and Siberia, where you get essentially what's been called lake effect snow, you know, like you get in Buffalo off the Great Lakes, where you get this, you have the waters open and then the cold air can come across and pick up the moisture and then dump snow on the coastline. We'd have what you'd call an ocean effect along the coastlines and much greater snowfall. And you also have, because the ocean is exposed, you see much stronger wave action that you wouldn't get with sea ice, and that can erode the coast. It can also erode, as we were talking about Greenland, these big, thick ice sheets that are coming off. The wave action actually is a pretty strong force. You don't think of it that way, but because water is essentially incompressible, it's pushing these ice sheets up and down that can be several hundred feet thick, and they're not real flexible, and that can help break off pieces of ice that normally wouldn't break off. And so all these are kind of indirect effects of the sea ice or the absence of it that we might be seeing.
The picture that's being painted is that it's a very complex system, number one. One might easily assume that things are warming up and therefore perhaps the Greenland ice sheet might start melting faster. But as you say, there's other countervailing forces that may mitigate that. So I don't think we're prepared to make a big prediction on what's going to happen in that.
Yeah, that's the thing. We don't really know what all the impacts are going to be. What we don't know is what's kind of the scary thing, because what we've been surprised a lot in terms of how we expect things might go, you know, and how things are going to go. And this is used by some people to kind of say, well, why should we do anything if we don't really know what the consequences are going to be. But it's kind of like, you know, you don't know exactly what the consequences are going to be, but what's turned out has been worse than what we might have guessed they would be. It's not better. We've erred kind of on a conservative side in terms of predicting what the what the effects are, and so that's a dangerous thing. You know, there may be some further surprises that are even worse than what we've experienced so far and what we might experience. And one of the things to point out is, you know, we've talked a lot about the Arctic sea ice and the impacts on locally in the Arctic and on Greenland, but you know, the Arctic is tied to the lower latitudes in the U.S. and Europe. And it helps set up the circulation patterns. You have this cold area at the north, and the sea ice helps keep things cold. And it sets up things like the jet stream and storm tracks. And it, you know, so it's helping to control where it rains or where it doesn't rain, even in lower latitudes, even throughout the United States, for example. And you take away this Arctic sea ice cap in the summertime, that could pretty dramatically change these circulation patterns. And that's something we honestly don't know exactly how they might change and what the impacts are going to be. But certainly, you know, areas, for example, there's been some preliminary studies that show without sea ice that the American Southwest might be drier. Well, I don't know if we can say that with any confidence, but given that water resources is already an issue in the Southwest, and it already is an arid region, if you suddenly are making it even more arid, that could have big consequences.
I'm in San Diego. We don't want to hear about that.
Yeah.
Because we rely on those southwestern water sources, you know.
Right. I mean, it's a huge you know, water resource issue for the entire Southwest, California, the Colorado, the whole American Southwest.
I thank you for that, because sometimes it seems like it's something that's happening up there, and quite honestly, though, it does have real consequences on real people all over the planet.
Right.
And as you say, that you just make such great points that, you know, I was trying to suggest, well, maybe there isn't that much change that we can look forward to. On the other hand, it could go quite the opposite. The trend line right now is that it's been dramatic change suddenly. That could continue, too.
Certainly. You know, it's possible that, you know, this year is just the first year in several where there's, you know, it's just going to be one dramatic decrease after another. Now, if it's as dramatic as this year, we only have about 5 years left
before we're
ice-free. Now, you know, again, I think there's natural variability that's going to come into play, and it's likely we won't have the kind of perfect storm of conditions we had this year. So my guess is that, you know, it won't be as extreme the next couple years, but
it's just a guess.
Right. It's a guess. And, at this point, I wouldn't be shocked by what we see in the next year.
Yeah. Well, we should be prepared for the fact that it could go that way. It could, I mean, just in 6-10 years, we could see that there really is no ice left. It could happen that way. We need to be prepared. Let's talk a little bit. I know that some of the folks that are involved in the NSIDC, the National Science and Ice Data Center in Boulder, Colorado, are involved in looking at some of the consequences this may have on the wildlife and cultures up there. What are they talking about?
Yeah, we have a researcher, Sherry Gearhart, who is actually stationed in the Arctic, on the coast of Baffin Bay, in an Inuit village. And she works with them quite closely to understand what they're seeing and what they've seen. They have a wealth of knowledge. It's not quantitative knowledge like we're used to seeing. You know, they don't take measurements per se, but they can look and they can say, well, normally at this time of year we can go out this far on the ice, or we can go hunting here, or we can walk across the ice to go to this village from here. And they're seeing really unprecedented changes up there. They're seeing things that, you know, they haven't seen in their oral history, that, you know, and that gets passed down from generation to generation. So it goes back, you know, several decades in terms of what their knowledge is, and they're intimately tied into it. You know, they're better than even scientists going out there taking measurements in some way, because their livelihoods depend on it. And so they notice things that your average person, maybe even a scientist, wouldn't notice. They can notice the quality of the ice cover in terms of how it feels under your feet and how it reacts and how springy it is and how strong it is. And that's something that, you know, there isn't that scientific knowledge base that goes back like theirs does. And they're seeing things that, you know, they can't do the things they're used to doing. Their traditional ways of hunting, of transportation, are really kind of disappearing. And they're having to adapt to new things, and it's quite dangerous for them, because in the past, they've totally relied on this oral history. You know, to go, when the ice is like this, you can go out on it, and all of a sudden, you know, a flow of ice would just break off, and you know, now it never used to happen that way, and now they're stranded, and they need to be rescued, and you know, it poses a danger to them, and so we're definitely seeing a lot of this evidence that's affecting them.
Well, I know that in my research, and I've talked to some people from those areas, they're pretty well convinced that this is a way of life that's gone, that they can no longer rely on this way of life, and that they're going to have to change. In many cases, they're moving. They're literally having to move their villages. And
yeah, there has been some villages moved, and that's partly due to this coastal erosion from the lack of sea ice.
Mm-hmm.
You're getting stronger storms, and you know, if you have houses on the coastline, they didn't used to have the storms they used to have, and now that's being eroded. But beyond that, they definitely have to change their ways of hunting. For example, you know, they used to go out in certain areas like in Baffin Bay in the winter time, and in the spring and fall, they would go walk out on the ice and take sled dogs out and hunt for seals. And now, you know, there's been, I think this last winter I've heard, you know, there's times, at least in certain villages, where they didn't really go out walking across or sledding across the ice at all, because the ice just wasn't enough of it there, and it wasn't strong enough. They went out in kayaks, and so their mode of hunting and the way they're used to doing things is changing. Certainly, you know, they may be able to adapt to some extent, but a lot of their traditional ways, they're going to have to adapt to things.
Of course, the big story that everyone is curious about, and it is a fascinating story, and that is, what is the plight of the polar bear that relied on that sea ice as a way of life throughout the winter and as summer, actually? What are people noticing? What are they noticing about perhaps some changes in the ways in which polar bears are adapting?
Well, polar bears rely on the ice. They hunt on the ice. They go out on the ice and they hunt for seals and walruses and whatever else they can find. And of course, the ice every summer it melts and it kind of pulls away from the coast. Now, historically, in many places it didn't pull too far away from the coast. So and it didn't pull away for very long. So the polar bears could kind of hang out for a few weeks, wait for the ice to come back in, and then they'd go out and feed. And they don't, you know, when they're sitting there waiting, they're not eating anything. And lately, and particularly this year, you know, they've had to wait a long time. You know, they can swim a long ways, and so they can certainly swim if there's some open water, but they couldn't swim near as far as they needed to get to the ice this year. And we're seeing from researchers that looked at this, polar bears are weighing less. They're having fewer cubs. There's been some reported sightings of polar bears drowning, in all likelihood. They've been found in the water that, you know, they just couldn't swim far enough to find a flow of ice to get out and rest on and go hunting on. There's been stories of polar bears hanging around human settlements more because they don't have a food source. Barrow, Alaska, in Churchill, there's been more what are called problem bears, where they have to wait, and of course they get hungry, and of course, you know, there is some food that humans have that it's not their main staple of diet, and they really probably shouldn't be eating things, but you know, if they get hungry enough, they'll take what they can get. There was a study that just came out this summer that by the USGS that looked at the polar bear habitats, and basically their assessment is that we may see at least two-thirds of polar bears, the polar bear population, gone within the next 50 years because their habitat just isn't survivable anymore because of the sea ice. Now,
and I just have to say, and that could be radically accelerated again because of these new
right.
these new developments. We just plain have to think about that because, you know, in our kind of worst-case scenario that we were talking about, that perhaps in 5 or 6 years there may not be any more sea ice, I think we need to really seriously mobilize on the planet here to deal with that and try to figure out what do we do, because it could happen.
Right. Yeah, it certainly, you know, this is something that could happen sooner, and, you know, whether polar bears will go extinct or not, that's a tough question, because, you know, maybe they can certainly survive not having ice for certain periods, and certainly some areas of the Arctic will, they may be totally ice-free at some point, but they probably won't be ice-free for a real long time, maybe only a few weeks. And so maybe a small population could survive there, or maybe they could adapt to other food sources, at least some of them could. But, you know, this is they're really kind of a specialized animal and specialized to the Arctic sea ice conditions. Mm-hmm. And maybe a population won't be large enough to withstand other stress factors that may come into play, such as disease or whatever. The polar bears is kind of emblematic of what we may have to deal with in the future. You know, the polar bear is certainly a lovable animal and touches the emotions of a lot of people in it. And no doubt would be a shame to go extinct, and it definitely would be tragic for the Arctic ecosystem. In terms of, you know, our own livelihoods, maybe it's not that crucial, but it's emblematic of things that we may be dealing with. We're going to have environmental stresses that we'll have to adapt to, and certainly we're more adaptable than polar bears, but it demonstrates that the Arctic change that we're seeing now and seeing accelerating is changes that the rest of the globe are going to be dealing with in the coming decades.
This is what concerns me, and I'm going to actually accelerate my efforts to try to do something because I think it's important, and that is that this is on our watch. It would be terrible if we just basically said, you know, maybe we could have done something, but it happened a little too fast and we just weren't prepared. I think we need to prepare. I really think it's extraordinary. The reason for this is the fact that you've got new information coming out that says things are happening a lot faster. We need to prepare. We're talking with Dr. Walt Meyer, who's with the National Science an ICE data center in Boulder, Colorado. A great conversation. For people who want to track this story and find out more about what you do there, why don't you give them some contact information?
Sure. They can visit our website, which is just nsidc.org, just our initials. And we have a variety of information on the ice conditions, and we track it through the year. And so you can see the latest information on the ice. We have several. We've been running a news blog this summer to track it, you know, week by week as things are changing. We'll probably do that again next summer, and we may even do it to some extent through the winter. Occasional updates. We have a lot of data, a lot of information on sea ice and all aspects of the cryosphere and snow and ice, whether it be snow cover, whether it be glaciers. We have a large index of photos showing how glaciers have been changing around the world, and that's another dramatic change that we're seeing throughout the globe on receding glaciers, as well as, you know, other permafrost changes that we look at, and you know, all kinds of information. So I would recommend, if people are interested, to go to our website and check it out, and we have contact information there that if they have questions, they're free to contact us. If there's questions of a scientific nature, the questions will get passed on to myself or other scientists who could answer them. And we're always happy to do that.
Well, Dr. Meyer, thanks so much for giving us this update. It's been very, very informative. You're an excellent spokesperson and a great communicator. And thank you so much for lending your voice here on the Wild Side News.
All right, thank you.
Get ready. I'm about to launch an advanced commitment to making a better world. You'll see what I mean in the months ahead. It is, after all, our way or not. This is Sidney Wildsmith saying adios until we meet again next Thursday or any time in the archives when your voice of the earth rings out around the world here on the Wild Side News.